Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 5/31/24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Roman came and had a few harsh meetings with us in those few years when he was more present, and this was translated, which makes it even harsher. You know, the Russian translated, you're waiting for the translation going, it's not going to be good, do you know what I mean?
I'm literally sat next to Ash in the dressing room for England for 6, 7, 8 years. Ash comes up to me screaming in my face after they scored the first goal.
You were talking about the timing into the box, and I was like, wow, this is incredible, especially for me as a midfielder. Probably should have followed you more than him. I got sent off a lot.
When I think of management, I only think of myself being successful. I don't even think of myself losing a game. And I do some any given Sunday speeches.
You said that you want to get back into the game, haven't you, in terms of the last 12 months?
But I'm wavering on that. Listen to Franco,
I absolutely love them toffee popcorn. I'm a great love of that. Toffee popcorn, honestly.
Are they the raspberry ones? No? Who got the chocolate?
Is there a bit of raspberry?
Are they the raspberry?
Are they?
I'm going to have one now.
Confirmed raspberry. It's been confirmed that they are raspberry mini rolls. Have you still got the pub, Frank, by the way?
Yeah, I have, yeah.
Oh, it's so beautiful, that pub. It's got a little old pub. You own the building, don't you?
Nice one, like me.
Honestly.
If you're not one, ain't got one around a pension.
What's a pension?
Go to the pub, it's pub in London. It's down a little street, like with Georgian houses, and it's a beautiful little pub on the corner.
I'm sharing is caring.
What's it called? The Chelsea Pig.
The Chelsea Pig,
it's good. So it was always called that, and you just bought it.
It's called the Pigs, yeah. And I used to go in there a little bit, and it came up, my dad, to be fair.
Yeah, your dad, you see, dad used to go in there, didn't
he? Yeah.
If you need more tea.
Thank
you. Yeah. You two look like
you've
got
it. Are you sponsored by him?
Stone Island. No, but I just something. It's a long. I just like it. It's just.
But it's a nice one. But why?
If Pep wears it, he's cool. If Pep wears it, he's cool. I wear it. I'm a football hooligan, Jill. You know what I mean?
You do look like my 15-year-old nephew right now.
Jill, you're a bit very aggressive today.
So I take it off and put my T-shirt on. Am I losing my confidence?
How often does this man lose his confidence?
Do you want me to change it?
If you can change it,
that'd be amazing.
What's that?
Change
what?
Be eternally grateful.
What for?
Sound.
Oh, he's pulling the neck. It wasn't that great anyway. To be fair.
I was going to message you, because, you know, after you were saying about my car, right?
Your G-Wagon, yeah.
So I broke down on Christmas Day for 4 hours.
No.
In the car, and I was going to actually text you.
But where were you driving though for 4 hours?
I was going up to... No, I was on the side of the motorway for 4 hours. I was going up to Sunderland.
To a dinner. There must have been a dinner on an
awards. Well, just my family dinner. No, it was Christmas Day. Christmas Day.
But why don't you just leave your car and get an Uber or something and get away?
All the way... What?
I wouldn't sit literally on the hard shoulder for 4 hours.
You can't just leave your car on a bloody motorway.
Are you not allowed to leave your car on the motorway on Christmas Day?
No, I don't think so. But this highway motorway.
The weeds would have been gone when you got back.
Turned up like to help us. And then they were like, oh, is any of you like ill in the car or anything? I was like, no. And then he started just pretending. So they left. They were like, sorry, we can't help lefters. Come back an hour later, and I thought, oh, they've thought Christmas Day they're going to help us. When my daughter plays football, would you mind just signing this thing? Signed it and then pissed off.
What, never shouted it out?
No, just left us.
Righty, he walks in, doesn't have to show his lanyard, just walks in, Jamie Carragher, Liverpool.
It is Anfield.
Right, makes sense, right? But they know who I am as well. They know I'm not going to turn up at Liverpool like without a lanyard. So literally, can we see your pass, please? You've not asked for his pass.
Yeah, but Gal, you can't.
You can't ask for his pass. Why have you asked my pass?
Gal, you can't give it the big one.
I'm going to give it the big one.
You did because like you didn't show him your pass. It's his job to see.
He doesn't have
pass.
To show his pass, but I do.
Yeah, it's Anfield. It's Jamie Carragher.
Quality.
Yeah, but you're Man United. They could do that just to wind you up. I thought it worked as well by the looks of things.
Is that your first one? Is that your second?
Second one. I've gone now. I'm in. I can feel I'm in.
Nice,
yeah, it's so nice.
You feel bad though when it's this time of the day?
No.
No?
Not at all.
Should we get over there? Ian, I like the tank top.
Well, thanks, Gal.
You've still got a polo neck on.
No, this is the roll neck, but I don't need... Yeah, the mic couldn't fit on that.
Why? Or the mic?
The mic couldn't fit on it. So I wore something that can, you know, can accommodate the microphone.
You don't. Thank you, man.
Which is still amazing. It just happens.
Looks good.
Thank you.
Must be midnight now, is it?
Right.
Right. Welcome to Stick to Football, brought to you by Sky Bet. And joining us this week is the Chelsea and England legend, Frank Lampard. What have you been doing for the last few months? Obviously, you were at Chelsea at the end of last season, but what have you been doing since then?
Enjoying a bit of time out, actually. Trying to be a good dad.
Good. How's that working out for you?
Yeah, I think it's going all right. I suppose it's one of the pitfalls of management, obviously, is when you're out of the game, because you want to work, but you've got to appreciate. I've certainly learned appreciation over the last few years. I've been managing for 4 or 5 years now. The year at Everton, I was up close to here, actually, away from the family a lot. Probably didn't realise until I came home what I'd missed, because my boy was like a year of age at that point. My daughter's 3 or 4, now they're 5 and 2. And spending time with them has been a great thing for me. Because even when you're managing, you're present, but you're not so many times. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So I've really appreciated that. A few other bits outside that I've always done, sort of, when you're unemployed as such, like full-time employment, everyone thinks you're available every day. So it's like, do you want to go for lunch? Do you want to do this? And I just like being at home a lot, if I'm honest. Yeah. So, just being happy out of the game and watching a lot of football, doing all those things.
Has it changed your perspective on anything in terms of whether you want to go back into management or whether you think, no, actually, now I'd like to do something different?
No, it hasn't. I enjoy it. And that's, you know, if you ask me in the heat of a moment in management, I think it's probably the biggest highs and lows you can have in the game. But especially from comparing it to a player, because I think you take so much more responsibility. So when you're working, sometimes you'll have moments where you're so high, back of a good result, or you're low because you've got problems, you've got issues, you're trying to get results, whatever it is. But I think when you come out of it, I think probably the best thing I think about experience for me as a manager is not that, you know, you get better tactically, you might find different ways you want to play. But I think it's learning as a manager to deal with those parts of the game, learning to not be, I think young managers can be really intense on yourself.
Yeah. Mm.
Every result that goes the wrong way, you're searching yourself. You can end up putting a lot more pressure on yourself.
Yeah.
So I think there's any balance I've found, it's like I want to work again. And what little bits can I do better maybe for myself to handle the obvious roller coaster that it can sometimes be?
I mean, I had that, to be fair, for a brief time and I was well out of my depth and didn't particularly want to do the job. I was struggling towards the end. Have you had moments like that in the last sort of 12 months where you've sort of had the difficult challenges obviously at Chelsea at the end of the season and Everton where you've looked in the mirror in the morning and you thought, yeah, it's coming on top a little bit?
I think at Everton it felt a bit like that in the end, and it was probably searching for results. It's always your job, coaching, trying to pick the right team, whatever, keep the squad happy. But Everton in the end, there were a lot of issues in and around it. You try not to get too waylaid by them because you can't affect it too much really, but we all know that there was an issue with the fans and the board at the time. And all those, I was on the phone a lot in the evening trying to connect with owner, chairman, everyone else, CEO, you know, and then go in and do the day job the next day. So I think at that time, I definitely found it an intense end period. I didn't find Chelsea as difficult personally because I knew it was finite. It was going to be 6-7 weeks. I learned very quickly in my head what the issues were there. And they were not my issues to solve long term. I don't want to sound like I palmed them off. Mm. It's just you want results, but at the same time, if you go into a place where you go, there's a lot of problems here, can I turn it around in 9 games when motivation has just gone down? Yeah. And I actually came to peace with that a little bit. I wanted to win games because it's my own reputation at the same time. But at the same time, I wasn't so bad there. Probably at the end of Everton would be the biggest spell. And you know what? It's a challenge. It sounds a bit corny. It makes you a better person, better coach probably after. Because you maybe learn next time that, you know what, all those phone calls I had, maybe I didn't need to get so involved in them. You have to be respectful. It's a speak to your owner and stuff.
But. Those phone calls, were they with the ownership and the problems that they're having related to what's happening now, or were they related to the sort of, if you like, the fact that they couldn't come to the games and the sort of disagreement with the fans? What, you know, with the FFP things that are going on, that was all obviously happening when you were there. Mm. What were those phone calls
I
about?
I think some of, a bit of everything. Some of it definitely was about the fans and the board. And I felt for the board, it's not easy to speak about when you're in it. You have to put on a media face as a coach. And sometimes you don't want to go against the fans, you don't want to against your own board. You go against your own board, that can be fatal for your job. But at the same time, I had a lot of feeling for people, like the chairman has obviously passed away. Mm. Bill Kenwright was a great support to me through the time. Really opinionated, loved the club. Yeah. It was Mr. Everton. And had a lot of... you end up very sensitive to the fact that this man can't come to games. You know, you can have an opinion on all the details, but this man's given his life to this club.
Yeah.
Denise, my CEO, was incredible. Yeah. She was trying to really put in a football plan. But at the same time, we got to the point probably, we were struggling for results a bit come January after the World Cup and the break in the season. And one of the problems I found at Everton was that we were trying to work a football plan. Kevin Thirlwell came in, sporting director. Denise was like, football plan, recruitment, what are we working towards? So we're working towards it. The minute January came in, it was like the Wild West, and agents and everyone, and what's it going to be? Who can we bring in? Yeah. We were struggling to be able to spend money anyway because of the FFP situation. I desperately wanted to bring in some players, and in the end, even after I left, I think it was another week, Sean came in at the back end. Couldn't really make any moves anyway. Anthony Gordon left the club. But there was a lot of tension at the club through that, and I think it had been a build-up. You'll know it well, Carr, as well, but it had been a build-up over a few years. I felt it from the minute I came in, until the minute I left. It was almost like we're in a bit of a crisis, but there's going to be another crisis. That was quite difficult. I think we managed it when we stayed up that year. Quite a lot of the thing, which let's build confidence and feeling. And I think we managed to get over the line with that. But in the second season, towards the end, it was challenging.
Where was Mashir in all this, Frank? So you mentioned obviously Denise and you mentioned Bill Kenwright, but Mashir is the ultimate owner. Where was he in all that?
More remote in terms of not being present, which is fine. I worked with Roman Abramovich for years. He wasn't present. We won a lot of things. You don't have to be present. So it'd be more on the phone having conversations. But I think the joined up nature of the club, which should have been, I think, a reason for...
Was it joined up though?
No,
it
wasn't. And you could then see why in the last 5 years they'd spent a lot of money in recruitment and it hadn't been joined up. And that came to roost a bit now, and we're seeing obviously the aftermath of that now.
I think being in the city and sort of having, you know, a few little links to Everton, there was definitely that divide on the board, and it's probably almost why the board sort of finished. It was almost Mashiri was on one side and Bill Kenwright and Denise Baxendale sort of on the other. And I always had the feeling, I don't know if you felt the same, when... Denise and Bill Kenwright and other people couldn't go with the game, and people were asking them to resign. Why are you still at the club? Why have you not resigned? Was the feeling that almost they needed to be there to almost somehow try and keep in check Mashir, because he could, when you're talking about the Wild West and agents coming around, was that feeling of yours that they were almost staying to actually, if we leave him to his own devices, things could actually get worse?
I think there would have been a bit of that in terms of there was definitely a different strategy from the owner to what the chairman's idea was about it and to what Denise's was. I think some of it would have been their own, determination to see it through. I think the chairman was a tough man. He was a strong man, do you know what I mean? As I say, he was very caring with me, and I went to his memorial recently, and the amount of people that spoke for him, I liked it in terms of how they were speaking, because it's what I sensed from him. You know, it can challenge you a lot. Denise was working everything to get this stadium over the line, which I think is going to change the club going forward, hopefully, and working with us to try and get it. So I think they were working their own way, as you say, in a direction on the ground much more. Denise, particularly for me, at the training ground, always trying to work forward, always trying to do problems. And so we got a few players over the line in the previous window, which absolutely Denise scraping and trying to do everything, communicating with the Premier League because we were in, you know, on a tight line. So I think they were just probably doing their job. And I understand why it would have hurt them deep down, being Evertonians, that they couldn't go to games. Had mistakes been made from different people? Of course they had been made. But I think there was a genuine good nature to them in wanting to try and keep the club in the league, try and keep moving forward.
How was it for you then? Because, you know, the FFP thing has just sort of dropped. Obviously, Everton have been docked 10 points. They've been, charged again. I mean, what was it like for you in terms of, OK, you're looking for players? And when you talk about Denise was talking to the Premier League, I mean, at any stage did the Premier League say, you can't buy this player or you've only got so much to spend? I mean, how did it work?
Yeah, there were a lot of details to that. And obviously, when Richarlison left the club, we all knew it was coming. Because it had to happen. So he left the club. It gave us a little bit of wriggle room to try and bring in some players there, because my view on it at the back end of the season was that we'd stayed up, but the squad needed a lot of work. And it wasn't just the idea of bringing players in. It was the idea of getting players to move on. Now, some of those players were probably, you know, at an age in their career, would sign long contracts. We're not going to go anywhere. The practical nature of any football club is sometimes you're then a little bit hamstrung by that. As I say, at that point, intentions were great of trying to bring players in. But the reality was, I think we were never really going to do it.
The Everton supporters are obviously fighting for the club in terms of the 10-point deduction and sort of attacking the Premier League, if you like. But, you know, those discussions, were they amicable with the Premier League? Was it almost a feeling that you were working together or they were sort of stopping you doing things going forward?
I was never really privy to them, so I would only get feedback off the back of it. So I think there was I think they were amicable to a point, but there were clear lines of what you could do at that stage.
Is it like frustrating as a manager because you've got all this stuff going on and really you just want to manage and coach your team, don't you? Like, did you do a lot of on the field coaching or did you feel like that's what you wanted to do? But there seems so much going on for managers that they don't get to just focus on the team sometimes.
Yeah, well, you've got to be wary of that because there's not much you can't do. And in terms of recruitment now, the modern manager is not the old school manager who's travelling up and down the country watching players to bring in. You have to leave that, pass that over to recruitment and the idea of what the club. You have those conversations and you go, right, what is my job? So I don't want to sound here now like I'm making a big smokescreen of what that back end period was like. It was like that. My main job was always to coach the team. And I am a coach. When I work, I want to be on the team with them, setting up game plan. Who we got next week? What's that going to look like? And when you're going through a tough time, you know, sometimes you go, next game's Brighton, then it's Man City, then it's Arsenal. And you go, how are we going to work around that? So absolutely, the big part of my priority and focus at that point was coaching the team, as it always is. And then, you know, dealing with all those other bits, something you've got to try and be able to handle. I mean, I can handle it. I definitely don't want to sound like a baby or making excuses here, because the real reason you leave the job is because you don't get results in that period. Do you know what I mean? Regardless of the 2 or 3 hours you might have on the phone at night, you've got to find a way to prioritise coaching. If that's what you want to do.
Lamps, with the fact that you're born into the game, you know, it's all you've known since you were growing up. Where's the enjoyment in the management for you? Where'd you get that something, Frank? Because like listening to this now, it sounds like everything apart from actually getting enjoyment and doing something that you love, which I know you do love, but where's the enjoyment?
Well,
did you get any, even with the wins? Could you even reflect and be happy for any time?
Yeah, I could be, definitely. And if I look back through my career, I've had big wins that have probably given me more fulfilment than any of my playing days. Unfortunately enough, you know, I won stuff with my playing days, whether it was because of Drogba or me or John Terry. I was in a great squad, you know, great setup. So, but when you are the manager, the feel of responsibility of, I don't know, getting Derby to the playoff final, and you beat Leeds, who are probably a better team now, you feel a big sense of, and keeping Everton up in the league. I mean, that's an enjoyment. Like that night, because of living in the city and starting to buy into it, and the Evertonians were so desperate to stay up, being a bit of a head figure as such in that moment is massive enjoyment. And then you do get the day-to-day working with young players, and you go to Chelsea, you feel linked and proud of a Reece James, or Mason Mount, or Tammy Abraham, players that go on to do good things. You don't take the credit for it, but you enjoy the day-to-day. Did I give some information? Did I give them an opportunity? Right. So there are loads of things. I definitely don't want to sound like you've just asked me about that end period at Everton, so focus on that. And the other parts, loads of other parts of my management. People will always can always make a big W, you left that club, that was a bad ending. But at the same time, I can look at the jobs I've had and go, at Derby, we had a good run. We actually got the club together. We got to a playoff final. Okay, we didn't make it through that. Chelsea, you won. We got to the Champions League and we brought in some players, same we, because of the staff and everyone that works together. So there are loads of good moments. And you do have to get a balance to it. You can't think I'm going to go and win everything.
Yeah.
Every manager's got relative success. You know, Pep wins most years. He's a brilliant manager. Mm. He's got fantastic players. The rest of us are looking for relative success, whatever that is. Mm.
Roy, where are you on that? I mean, you obviously have said, obviously Frank just said he wants to get back into the game, and you said that you want to get back into the game, haven't you, in terms of the last 12 months?
But I'm wavering still on that. Listen to Frank.
I'm sorry about this. I'm going to bring it on. I'm going to be more upbeat.
You just ended Roy Keane's managerial career.
Sorry, Roy.
No, it is.
Do you want to get back in? Are you serious you want to get back in?
But it's got to be. Can I go back to it? Not that you're going to get the Real Madrid job, but it's got to be the right challenge. It's got to be the right club. It's got to be the right contract. So can you bring your staff? And I discuss this all the time. I have had opportunities, but sometimes you get offered a contract. I go back to Dubai, look at it. If I do get offered stuff, a bit of self-worth. You know, is the deal right for you? Whatever. I'd like to go back in, but I'm not desperate when I sign any contract for anybody. But even your experience, Frank, remember, all them are experiences that will definitely will make you a better manager.
Yeah.
As you said, the off-the-field stuff, dealing with board members. That is tough. That can sap your energy when you... And maybe some clubs, there's a crisis. There's always a crisis in there. Yeah. And maybe Everton will be one of them for the next few years, you know, fighting relegation, dealing with boards. And at a club, unless you're at a really well-run club, there are those challenges off the pitch. If it was just about going and working with a team, it'd be great.
Is one of the things why you want to go back into management is that people talk about the day-to-day and it, you know, gives you something to do. I mean, for me, I always think about you with the Ireland job. You know, whether that would work for you, obviously that wouldn't be day-to-day. Yeah. But would that be something that would
be something. Yeah, international football. I enjoyed it when I was a coach there for a while. I liked the dynamics of it, again, where you're not in every day and it's not about bringing players in and, I suppose, dealing with the board every week or whatever it might be and the academy. Yeah, that does appeal. I did enjoy the dynamics when I was coaching with Martin, with the Irish team. Yeah, but then we had a little bit of success and you look back and when you've had a little bit of success, then it's brilliant. But obviously there's disappointment. So, yeah, that would be... That could be an option, Jim.
Ooh.
Big news,
Nice one, Jim. We got it out of him.
We got there in the end.
See the headline, he's keen.
He's keen. Nice one, Jill. I'm Jill Scott, man. Go on, Gal, what are you going to say?
The last question on Everton, you mentioned, I think, earlier on about Mashiri's strategy and you said that, obviously, Denise and Bill Kenwright were trying to defend what was going on. But what is the strategy of Mashiri at the club? Because a lot of Everton fans probably wouldn't know.
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure about that. Mm. I'm not saying that too loosely because I came into it probably, I don't know, 4 or 5 years he'd been there before I got in there. But, you could see that it had been... four managers, Marco Silva, Roberto Martinez, Carlo Ancelotti, Benitez, Big Sam. Sorry, so really high-level managers when you go through that, Champions League winners, etc. And I came in and you could see with the squad, in terms of the squad, there wasn't a strategy. And this happens at football clubs. You know, new managers come in and want to go a different way. So, but if you can have a bit of a strategy of what you want to be, I wasn't sure what it was because we were having conversations about Frank, how do you want to coach your team? Now I've got an idea. You go, okay, I want to do that. I go, but we're going to have to recruit a bit for that because I can't make this team exactly what I want it to be now.
Yeah.
Which is probably why at the end of my time, when we stayed up, we went to a back five and we were really compact. We engaged the fans. Mm-hmm. We got up the pitch. Anthony Gordon was flying at that time, and we got some pace in the team, and we fought our way out of trouble to it. And it was great for me. Like the idea of having an experience when you're in a tough moment, you become a better coach. Mm-hmm. But in terms of what the club idea was at that point, no. And again, I don't want to sound like this is making a real negative on Mashiri or the big decision makers over those years, because I'm sure they did it because they brought Everton to make it into a fantastic club that was a success. Yeah. Who wouldn't do that? You'd be crazy not to. It's just maybe when you were... I worked at Man City for a year at the back end of my career and I went into a structure. I was a player, so you don't know everything. But you look at it and go, this place is going to go places because there's a vision. And they're going to go away, and then Pep Guardiola comes a year later or whatever. But when you lose a couple of games, it's not like, oh, what are we going to do now? Sack that, change that. It was almost like it's going to go, and it's going to go. And obviously, at Everton, it hadn't had that for whatever reason.
But you were smart. You were smart when you went in first, Frank. Obviously, I'd listened to you, and I'd watched some of the first few games. And you, no doubt you were trying to play a kind of an open game, and that's what you used to in your career. But the penny, at least the penny dropped for you when you first went in going, listen, lads, we need to shut up shop here.
Yeah.
We need to play a certain way. And that's management, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because people talk about what's your philosophy, what's your plan. We all have great plans until you walk in the door and then you see a certain group of players, you go, listen, we're short here, there's lack of confidence. Everton have to stay up. Mm. That is the priority. So it's about results. So that's, to me, that's what management is about. So.
I've found as well that the easier part of that is, for me, was that when I went in, it was written all over the faces of the players. So I tried to go in and go, right, we're going to be a bit, not expansive, is the wrong word, but, you know, we're going to play a bit. And the idea, we beat Brentford in the cup in the first game, and we lost a couple of games on the road. Then we beat Leeds well at home. and we were pressing, and it was like 4-3-3-ish, a bit 4-4-2, but we were doing everything we wanted to do. And then we went and got spanked in a few games away from home. And I could see that the players, it wasn't a big ask to say, you know what, lads, we're going to protect here now.
Yeah.
And we're going to have five at the back. And then we did get some results with it. And we had the Goodison thing, because in that time for me, we were beating Man United at Goodison. We beat Chelsea at Goodison. And the crowd were rallying behind us. And it was giving the players, you know, a massive lease of life. So it was, we got over the line. It was a really interesting coaching situation for me. I learned a lot on that front. And I've got to say, the elation of staying up was definitely one of the...
Was coaching about just tuck in, lads? Tuck in, let's sit in. Yeah, go along.
But you know,
and at Everton, it worked at the time. And it kind of, sometimes that type of play does suit Everton, doesn't it?
I think it does, yeah.
Seamus Coleman, a good character for you, Seamus. Yeah,
Seamus was amazing.
Good guy, isn't he, yeah.
So the first day I sat with him, so now I messaged him the other day because he made his, was it 15 years ago?
That was incredible, that.
It's amazing. Incredible. And what a player as well, by the way. I remember him playing against him, and I didn't really appreciate it, so I went and worked with him because at that point he's 33. But it wasn't just what he did on the pitch, it's what he did off the pitch. Yeah. His standards, his humility, everything about
proper team player, isn't he?
Honestly, like, you know, family man, but there's not a bit of him that's not genuine. And he wore it on his face when we were struggling. It was like, I really care about this. You want to say to the other players, but he'd speak in front of the players on his own. I remember we spoke about you once, I think, on Monday Night Football, and you'd had a dig at the players, said they're not good enough or whatever. And he used you as a reference point. And he went, I was watching Monday Night Football last night. Did you watch it? To all the players.
Yeah.
All the players. Probably 90% put it up. And he went, and Jamie Carragher said this. And it wasn't necessarily a dig at you, he's probably using it in a smart way. It was basically going, don't accept that. Do you know what I mean? As players and as managers, we have to take some stick. Do you know what I mean? But the only way to do it is to react to it.
Mm.
And it was a bit of a turning point for us. I can't remember the exact moment of it, but he was always the man to do that.
He seems a bit funny with me on the last game of the season.
You never thought you'd be motivating Everton.
That's most Premier League dressing rooms on a Tuesday morning, that, to be honest with you.
See what he said?
I'm just listening. I'm thinking to myself, I'm still trying to find the joy. I don't know.
I'm a little bit the same.
Yeah, because when I think of management, I only think of myself being successful. I don't even think of myself losing a game. Honestly, right, I don't even think so. I'm thinking, I watch some things and I think, wow, I wish, if I went in there and I'll do some Any Given Sunday speeches and I'll get the lads going and we'll play great stuff. But then I've not heard anybody tell me about the joy of it.
I had this conversation, I thought you might remember this, about 10 years ago. The first time I ever did punditry, we worked together on ITV, I think in the Euros 2012, and Gareth Southgate was on the panel and Roberto Martinez. And so three managers, I had to go up management.
And I was two really good managers, yeah. Sure.
And when we were going to the bar after the show, I think Gordon Strachan was there as well.
Yes.
And everyone was talking about sort of the problems and this. And I said to you, why did you do it? And I remember you saying to me, you said, being a manager is like a night out. You know, you're having a night out, and the second you get up Sunday morning, you go, never again. And then you get to Friday, you put your gear on. You know what I mean? And that's the type of thing.
Yeah.
Just like, I don't see that much.
Yeah.
Do you not miss being on the grass, though? Like, now.
You know what? I hate that saying.
It doesn't mean what you think he'll do.
Get on the grass.
Just back from Thailand.
No, but I do. Get on the grass. I don't know. Just that I want to go into coaching.
No, I can't stand it.
I don't miss. I don't.
No, I can't.
People always
say,
"Oh, miss the dressing room." I don't.
But not even just kicking a ball about.
No.
I loved it, but it was just like that. Oh no.
Was punditry not enough for you, Frank?
I wouldn't say it's not enough. I think that's disrespectful to it because I enjoyed it and allowed you to have a nicer lifestyle, you know. It's like we'll work hard on the table in our different ways, but like it's from being a player, obviously. So I enjoyed it. I enjoyed the preparation. I wanted to be as well prepped as I could. I wanted to do as good a job as I could.
But you were good at it as well.
I thought I was okay, but you always want to be better at it and do what you do and look around and see other people doing it really well, and you kind of want to be as good as you can. I just enjoyed the period of doing it, and you know, it actually gave me an eye towards the analysis thing, which you're going to do when you're a manager, and it's done so well now. That's why I appreciate good analysis. And I appreciate where I can see prep's been done and someone's watched the game rather than just gone, they pressed higher, they didn't, you know, like the generic stuff.
Yeah.
I saw you the other day, the Man U game, you talked about the midfield boy and you were talking about two tens either side of you, cover the space, wait, and then you know where to go. And like, for me, if I'm sitting home, that's what I want to hear. I want to hear Roy Keane show me and tell me exactly why, because he did it for 20 years.
Cheers,
or
Frank. Yeah.
No, but it was. Like, no, but I appreciate. No, but you guys, you've done that on Monday Night Football and made it an amazing show. And right, when he talks about movement, of, you know, whatever it might be, like those things, I think are good to this. Is what I would want to be that version of that. But then, when I got into management, the sort of drug to be the flip of the negative side of it is, can you get improvement? And the more you go into the whole of that, because I want to be a coach and I want to coach the players, and I want to give them ideas, and I want to show them what they could do to be better. You do buy into that yourself. I watch games of a completely different eye than what I did 5 years ago or thought as a player. So you actually want to get improvement. You want to improve players. And then, you know, like I said, about the younger players, I have been able to be part of the journey or the project. But you know what I mean? You do take a sense of pride in that and enjoy that. So there are lots of things to say.
You're on about changes. Sorry, like with staff, do you constantly, not that you blame the staff for, you know, when you've had a bad result, but you look back and you think, maybe I'll tweak that with more experience or whatever it might be. No, or were you really comfortable with everyone around you? Yeah,
I was. I had a really good group, and we got on very well. I know it's not about that. It's not about a lad's trip, but we were up living
helped
up.
It does help if you get on with
it. So the staff office, like, as much as sometimes at Everton, again, could have been challenging towards the end, we had a real laugh in the office about a lot of things. I wouldn't repeat the stuff. work again. But we had a good laugh, and people, you know, Joe Edwards now managing at Millwall, Chris Jones I've worked with since I've started managing, Paul Clement as well, who's obviously worked with Carlo and all these clubs and managed himself. So we had Ashley Cole, so we had a lot of experience in the room. I certainly wouldn't put it down to any of my staff or, you know.
No, I wouldn't say you're putting it down to them, but if you were back without a job, would you say, listen, if one of them is tied up, I'll leave them to it and I'll just...
Well, one has since gone on to be managing Millwall, so I think you do have to think like that. And sometimes those challenges are good for you as well. It's always making you think what you're good at and what maybe you need someone else that's better than you at. Analysis, whatever it might be, set pieces.
I look at you and sort of Stevie, I'm probably Wayne at the minute, and you sort of, you're looking at Wayne Rooney at Birmingham and getting stick off the fans. You're talking about sort of ups and downs of the job. Stevie's in Saudi now. And do you think you almost want to be a coach? You're a coach and you're a manager now. That's you. Because when I worked with, say, Brendan Rodgers or Rafa Benitez, they're going to be a coach or a manager till they're 60-odd. It's just that's their thing. Do you not sort of envisage in the future you being maybe an ambassador somewhere, or maybe working for UEFA and doing a TV gig? Are you in the management stuff or sort of thinking, I'm going to give this another sort of 4 or 5 years and then try and get out? Or do you see this as going into your sort of 60s?
I don't go beyond the 4 or 5 years. I think you probably have to have that, because I think if you don't, you could probably easily get waylaid off of it, because there's a lot of challenges. Now I'm sitting waiting for an opportunity. You might go for a job and you don't get it, or you might just be waiting around. And so I think then you could go down different routes. I know exactly where I'm at, that I want to do it because I do enjoy doing it. And I actually, it's probably a deep down desire to get better at it and do the best I can at it, because I've always been like that a bit as a player. I haven't lost that. And as much as you try not to listen to outside noise, there will always be outside noise. It's me, Stevie, Wayne, particularly because of probably our playing careers.
Yeah.
I think it's of good interest to people that have probably watched you have a pretty good playing career for 20 years. And then go, I'm not going to just give you an easy ride into management, though. And they kind of presume that you just went, I'm going to finish now, I'm going to be a manager. And here's my, you work bloody hard.
Do you think there is a level of disrespect? I want to talk about that. Do you think there is a level of disrespect? Obviously, this like, sort of golden generation of managers, and it's almost been the last few weeks, because of what's happened with Wayne in particular, there's an element of ridicule, which is unfair.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a point, because the golden generation thing was a nonsense anyway, because no one proclaimed us a golden generation. There's some good players in that squad, but so did Italy and France, and they had Zidane, and they had Pirlo, and that, you know, like, international football is always a challenge to win, and that's an old story now. But of course, it's nice to rehash the story and go on result. But every manager, like, it doesn't matter whether you're... I don't want to cry too much here, because every manager gets a tough run. Every manager will be top of the tree after a few wins, and in threat of getting a sack within a few, whether you're part of the golden generation, just an English manager or a foreign manager. But I would say probably in the last recent period, there's not really been a young British manager that's come and been a bit of a standard bearer for it. So there's always this kind of, he's another one that's not really as talented as, because to be fair to foreign managers, starting with probably Arsene Wenger, Jose Mourinho, Pep Guardiola, Jurgen Klopp, they have made a massive difference to the tactical nature of the game in 20 years. Not an English manager in that list. But at the same time now, there are a lot of English coaches. And I think it is a stick to beat you with sometimes, the golden generation thing. It's hard. That's another headline for now. Poor old us, do you know what I mean? The golden generation, we're still good.
That's what we want on this podcast.
Yeah, there you go.
To be fair, Frank, because to be fair, I looked at this quite a bit in the last few days, and it's this thing about who's a successful manager and who's deemed not a successful manager. And, you know, I was looking at the win percentages of, say, the golden generation. Stevie's win percentage overall is 57.1%. Yours is 41.3%. You know, Waz's is down at 25%. Mine was 35%. And Valencia Scholes's was 30.8%. I'm just saying five there.
35%? Are you serious?
I'm at 35%.
Nice then, one, guys.
Is that Copa del Rey?
But what's staggering? And look, the equivalent charity shield. Friendly is that. But then you think about these managers who have unbelievable careers. Sean Dyche, Graham Potter, Roy Hodgson, Sam Allardyce, Eddie Howe. And you know, Roy, your win percentage overall is 38.7%. Eddie Howe's is 35%. Sam Allardyce's overall win percentage in the Premier League is 32%. Roy Hodgson's overall win percentage in the Premier League is 32%. Graham Potter's, who's deemed an unbelievable manager, and I think he's a great coach, 28%. Wow. Sean Dyche is 28%. Now, that's what I'm talking about in terms of they're deemed to be very successful. Yeah. I think you mentioned this quite a few times, Roy, over the last few years. And we would say they are successful managers, but they've got probably 300-400 games under the belt. How do you two, who have maybe only had one difficult job between, you know, you've had one difficult job at Ipswich, you had a difficult job at maybe Everton in the last few months. Mm. How do you get to 10 jobs, 12 jobs like they have when your win percentages are higher than those, but you're deemed already to potentially be, oh, where's your next job going to be?
Because you need that's over a longer period.
It is. I'm not disrespecting them at all. I'm just saying.
You have to look at the clubs and the situations.
Yeah. So how do young managers, when they're being written off with percentages of 40%, 38% as an example, why would you give them a job? When actually they've got higher win percentages than some of the ones that are deemed have got incredible careers.
Well, yeah, unfortunately, you sort of have to ignore it because I know perception's a big thing. You just talked about it there. Yeah. And I think our careers maybe then get held on us a bit. You know, I think yourself even, going to Valencia, you decided then you're going to go down your own route. But there'll be an element of people that will probably sit in back in England and go, it didn't work for him out there. Do you know what I mean? That's a reality. Definitely. That's the real world that we live in. Yeah. So you've got to try and ignore it or you get drawn on the silly article that just throws that up without any context of where you worked at. You know, Sam Allardyce will be low because he kept keeping clubs in the league that maybe didn't deserve to stay in the league or whatever it is. So I think that's a perception. You just got to put it to the side and work forward. But I know what you mean. It can have an effect. It's the world.
Do you think it's because those managers maybe took jobs lower down to start with and then went like that, and maybe the jobs that say the golden generation have gone in a lot higher, and maybe there's that perception that
I think that's where people, there's an element of where if you finish and you've had a decent career and you get a decent job quickly, I think there is that resentment towards managers who've had a good career. And just say, you might mention a few managers who were down the lower leagues and they learned their trade at League One or League Two in 200-300 games, and they sometimes get away with it, I think, when they get better jobs. But I think people are waiting for certain players who've had a certain career, if they've seen they've got an easy job quickly or a big job quickly. Yeah. Yeah. I think there is that idea of like, oh, well, sometimes you don't get the benefit of the doubt as much as other managers when you've had a difficult spell, because every manager, even the great managers, go through difficult spells.
They can't... players with a big name, a great player, you can't make your mistakes, if you know what I mean. So the managers you're talking about there, Roy Hodgson, I think, started in Sweden. We don't really know how it went, or obviously he did really well at the time. But I think Sean Dyche was at Watford initially.
Graham Potter. Yeah.
So what I'm saying is, even when they're having a good time or a bad time, they're going a little bit under the radar in terms of them. Whereas you can't.
Everything's right in the spotlight.
Stevie can't win. Everyone's like, and it feels like everyone in this country was desperate for our Pep Guardiola, because everyone says, well, Pep does it. He went straight in Barcelona. Pep Guardiola is a genius. He's probably going to be the greatest manager of all time.
There's pluses and minuses. You have to hold your hand up and you go, listen, because of your career, that has given you an opportunity.
Sure. Yeah.
But then you're not giving that bit of breathing space when you have a difficult spell, because again, the first thing they throw at you is, oh, you're never going to be as good as what you are as a player. And there's some of the hang ups you have to face. Eddie Howe's had it, I suppose, a little bit. Eddie Howe was going to be this and that. Then Newcastle going through a difficult spell. But he started off really well, obviously. I know he obviously Bournemouth. Done really well at Bournemouth. Went to Burnley for a while, came back to Bournemouth. There's challenges for every manager.
Yeah, it's not
they
just...
They don't get enough time, though. Like, Rooney, how long was he in that job? It's crazy. Like, I think we spoke about it before, but you're going into a club, you've got to change everything. You get a bad run of results. I feel like back in the day, they didn't just get rid of you after 12, 13 weeks. And I think it takes time, so...
But that's your decision-making, though. The club you're picking as well, do you know? Yeah. Birmingham, I know they were doing okay at the time. Even Wayne stuff at Derby, I'm sure that was difficult. Off-the-field stuff, and he gets to the States. So everyone's got a different journey. But yeah, but Wayne... But a lot of managers say, you say you don't get enough time. Of course not. Obviously not.
No. You know, it ramps up as well when you get a manager that weren't doing badly. You know, and then it feels like, oh, they've bought old, like, boom, okay, stump that out.
Yeah.
Instantly you're under pressure. It's a horrible situation.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
We've mentioned Golden Generation and send our best wishes to Sven-Goran Eriksson. Yeah. And I know you like talking about the Golden Generation, but there's this feeling, Frank, and I don't think I've ever spoken to you about this, that we could have been set up better, we could have potentially been more sort of progressive, we should have achieved more. And I just wrote a team down this week in a system of play that had David James in goal. We've got three centre-backs of Sol Campbell on the right, Rio Ferdinand in the middle and John Terry on the left. Mm. Got David Beckham right wing back, who played there under Glenn Hoddle. Ashley Cole left wing back.
He's dropped himself.
He wants to win something. Yeah.
Paul Scholes in midfield dictating the play, holding like Pirlo did. Mm. You and Stevie obviously moving forward in those number eights. And then Wayne Rooney and Michael Owen up front. I picked that team and I thought, if we were set up in that way, could we have won something? Do you think the Golden Generation should have won something? Now, you said that France before had better players. I sometimes go along with that theory as well. But do you think there is an element of us potentially being set up in a more progressive way that could mean that we would have been able to keep possession more and do more in tournaments? Because you were part, obviously, of the 2004 and 6. And
I think it's such a long conversation, this one, because, and I float a bit with it, like you said there yourself, because I do think at times we were probably too rigid. And when I say that, I talk from my own personal experience of playing in World Cups against teams that were not at our level. So I'm not talking about France and Italy now. That's a different playing against Ecuador. So
that were keeping the ball off us.
And they were keeping the ball in the field because they're outnumbering us in the centre of the park. So the things that maybe me and Stevie get used to doing, where we had numbers or we were used to, now you're just trying to cover space. Yeah. And you actually get a bit mentally done with it in the game, going, why is this happening? And I think we were probably struggling. That would be, you know, Fabio Capello, one of the greatest managers in terms of his record in Italy, coming in, went with that very rigid structure as well, because that was his way and he'd had great success with it. But for us, I do think, but there are a lot of factors to it, like Paul Scholes factor. Scholes is an incredible player. I remember when I sort of first got into the squad, I probably upset the apple cart a little bit because I was another one that was sort of attacking midfield, and now you've got three of them. And I know Scholes went on the left of a diamond, and we had a decent Euros that year, but we got knocked out. So then Scholes, he kind of retired from international football, I think, for his own reasons, whatever they were. Then went into that kind of deeper role at Man United and became a quarterback and was unreal. Now you can casually look back and go, why didn't you just put Scholes there?
Yeah.
But he wasn't playing there.
At that point, he wasn't playing there. He was arriving into the box. I remember him scoring those two goals against Scotland in ball over the top for you. And at that time, you know, like, he was an incredible player throughout his whole career, but the circumstances had changed. And, you know, so there were Wayne and Michael didn't quite played together in that too that much, like Wayne, and then Michael started to get his injuries, and then Wayne came into the team. So it was never as clear cut. It was a good squad, and maybe with some different, you know, layering, getting another body in midfield for sure, I think would have helped. It certainly would help.
But what the dynamics of people together? Was a lot of egos? Yeah. Was a years? Yeah, you'd hear stories about Liverpool against United. Yeah, was that all going on?
There was a bit of that.
So if you're looking at good players on paper, it doesn't mean the dynamics in the group is going to come together.
Yeah.
And England do have that now, don't they? They have that togetherness. Yeah. I think Gareth Southgate's really focused on that, which
and deserves
does help.
Massive credit for that.
But for all the experienced players, could the group deal with all that stuff? Because they had expectations week in, week out at their clubs.
We've got to take that on the chin, I think, as the players for that one. I think it was a bit of naivety. I was mid-20s or whatever I was when I got into the team full-time. And I look back now and I would go, yeah, I probably did sit with the Chelsea boys on the table
too. Yeah, and I was the same.
Didn't link with them. You know, I think you just take that one on the chin. Yeah. It doesn't mean we would have won or lost the game necessarily, but over a period of
time. But even the expectation, I mean, Frank, the group of players should be going, there is expectation, yeah. Okay, not everyone's going to be best pals together, but talking about pressure playing for England, but you were getting pressure week in, week out of your club, yeah. Sorry, that. I'm surprised that was such a, that would kind of really creep into the camp and affect players when a lot of these players were winning big trophies at their clubs every season. Yeah. But
it's harder in national football when you've had that massive game, haven't you, like Arsenal, Chelsea, Liverpool, and then you meet up with England and it's like you've had to be the biggest rivals and then suddenly the next day you're like, come on then, let's get on with it. So I used to sometimes find that a little bit difficult. It was kind of like leave your club hat at home and then now run international. And same with style of play as well. You go from playing a club football in a certain way and believing in it and then you have to go away with Phil Neville at England and believe in his style of play and have like an open mindset and stuff like that. And sometimes you're so drilled in by your club, aren't you? Because that's your philosophy day in, day out. So was it a case of sometimes when that golden generation came together, you had the Liverpool lads that believed in a certain way of playing, the Chelsea boys or...
Yeah, maybe. And again, I think we have to take responsibility because that is the test and the, you know, of international football. You have to be able to go and be adaptable and understand what the...
Basically the Chelsea lads, wasn't it? It was the Chelsea lads.
Well, we got told for about 6 months after we got knocked out of World Cup, everyone went, me, John and Ashley were getting pelters. Everyone let us know it was our fault.
That's what Neb kept telling us when we see came back. So you wouldn't believe them Chelsea lads, But Sven was linked with United, wasn't he? He was supposed to be coming in. But you all liked Sven, didn't you? He used to come back.
Absolutely, yeah. We really liked him. But, and to be fair, I've always taken the sort of same opinion as Frank that I look back and think of as players, we disappointed and we fell below our standards and other countries had great players. But then I just think when I look at sort of how we played under Terry in Euro 96 or maybe Glenn, and I think of how we were rigid for about 8 years, as you were at Liverpool, quite rigid, weren't you, and sort of compact in defence. And then it's very difficult to get out from that. And the ball was being kept off us by teams that were inferior to us. And you wonder whether it would have been different if we'd have gone for a more sort of progressive system or something. You just, you know, it's a question.
Yeah, but when you changed it with Glenn...
No, Glenn was before.
Yeah, but when you change it with Terry Venables. Terry Venables, was he not playing...
Terry Venables, it was Terry Venables and then it was...
Glenn Hoddle.
Yeah, but was that Terry Venables in, you know, making like inviting you to play a nice style of football?
And, yeah. No, absolutely. That's what I'm saying to you. We play different systems.
But he still didn't win.
Why don't you just say
that?
It is a good point. No, you have this in your head. If we played a certain way, we could have won. No, you still, listen, as you know, still fine margins.
Yeah.
You still have to get over the line in certain games. And so even when you did start playing and you were having more possession and getting more balls in the box and brilliant strikers like Shearer, listen, it still came up short.
I think you're right. But what I would say about that is I think when I hear players talk about Euro 96 and maybe the World Cup in 98, it feels like there was an enjoyment. Yeah. I mean, I was in the squad without really being in the team, but I don't ever felt like we enjoyed it that much, you know, the tournament, because you'd sometimes get a result, but everything felt like a grind, didn't it? Mm. You know, it just didn't feel
like...
But
yours was in England again, Jamie. Yeah. Sorry, I'm throwing the spanner in the works here. But when you're playing at Wembley all the time, you get that momentum, it's going to be good, isn't it?
It's more pressure.
And obviously, lads are based in England, you've got family. Surely all that comes in, because a lot of Ireland would do it. When you go away, and you sometimes been away for a kind of long spell, didn't seem to suit certain countries. Because you'd always hear the Brazilian lads, they love being away for 4 or 5 weeks together. But as you said, if especially if you think lads weren't getting on that well together, that does make it a long tournament you're away. Yeah.
Were we that bad? Was it that bad?
I don't think it was that bad.
I don't think it was that bad.
No.
No, I'm not saying it was that bad. I'm just saying.
It was them.
Was it?
It was you.
Well, Scorsese never used to like going away. For example, Scorsese used to come back. You're on about, you know, Scorsese kind of retired from England.
2004.
He was still fairly young, but he used to come back and he didn't like it.
I would think the Man United boys. I'm not pinning it on you.
It is.
We were a generation slightly younger than you, Chelsea lads. So when I remember coming to the squad and looking at the Man United team and going, ooh. Like that they would have, you were the governors of the room as
well.
But
Gary, you wouldn't
in a negative way.
Well, Gary made an effort, Frank. Sorry, you were fairly quiet, weren't you? You wouldn't have gone over I just can't visualise you going over to the Chelsea lads, for example. Just
it was good when there was a cause. You know what I mean?
Strike.
Union man. Union man.
It was great.
Gary was the kind of person that when you go back and they say, what was he like? What's Gary Neville like? He said, I'm not sure.
No.
That's when we should go with United. He's got to bed early. I couldn't imagine him sitting down all night.
Only sit on the Man United table.
Having a card school. Did he get a card school?
I love Gary.
That's my point. Dinner was 7 o'clock. So you get there maybe a couple of minutes before.
They're already finished. Under dessert. Honestly, God, the Man United, they're all sat there, they're done. Yeah. And it's like, fuck.
Card school? Did you get involved in the card school?
No, I didn't do card school. No.
But this is all not a diversion.
There were six of us in the squad. There was a lot of us there.
Yeah, like, there were a lot of you there. And environment is clearly big because we'll talk about it at different times. You need a good environment. But you don't have to be best mates. Mm. And I remember one thing I remember from yourself and Phil, actually, players, was your mentality. I remember the warm-up she's doing in the dressing room now. Like, Phil used to do doggies in the back of the dressing room. Yeah. I thought it was a bit much.
She's still doing them?
In a positive, I looked up to her. I was like, yeah, this is what Man United, because you were winning everything, pretty much.
But you know something, Greg?
That wasn't under Gary and Phil.
In all of our defences, I think it was quite an intense period between United, Chelsea, Arsenal, Liverpool. There's a lot of... If you remember,
we're all going for the Champions League
between sort of that period of 5-6 years. Sure. Jose had come in, he was trying to create a siege mentality. Wow. Arsene Wenger was obviously with the Invincibles. Yeah, Liverpool was starting to get closer with, obviously, Rafa Benitez. And there was a lot of anger there between Sir Alex Ferguson and Rafa Benitez. So it was all a bit like you were at each other's throat.
But the manager ever get you together, this is my point, and feel that tension, and even if you go, it's not that obvious, you're not going down and not speaking to people, but you're missing something.
It wasn't that bad, but it'd be little things for me. So I know Glenn tried to, for instance, he brought in a single table. So basically, rather than having the four round tables of 10, and then you might sit on different tables, he would bring in the one big table, so you're all sat basically around one table, and things like that can help.
What else?
I think one of the problems was...
Just a table.
Quiz night.
I think within that rivalry, if you thought of Chelsea at that time, it was you and John. Yeah. It wasn't just like you were in the team. You were and it probably felt a little bit like sort of Liverpool was me and Stevie, and you were like the class of 92. So it wasn't just the teams were against each other. The big figures within those teams were sort of like the leaders.
Did you like going away with England?
No, not really.
I remember
for that reason or for football.
Oh, not
reason.
To do with that. Roy, I played.
Roy,
do you remember that game? But you must have enjoyed being together and training with others. No,
Roy, the tunnel game. Roy, the tunnel game. Arsenal. That game. You remember how Arsenal were that game? They were so fired up before the game. Arsenal scored the first goal, don't they?
Right. What was that? The 2-2.
No, the 4-2. We win in the end. Yeah. Oh, was that? We win the game.
Was that Sharpie?
No. It was Ronaldo. Well after that, it was well after that. Ashley Cole. I'm literally sat next to Ash in the dressing room for England for 6, 7, 8 years. Ash comes up to me screaming in my face, you fucking... After they scored the first goal, right? Ashley Cole, the most placid. You know, Ash is a brilliant lad, isn't he?
Yeah.
Another great lad, yeah.
But Ash comes screaming in my face. I'm like, what the fuck?
Should have booted him.
Right? So literally, like a couple of weeks later, you literally sat there next to him. Yeah. So much was going on. You obviously with Chelsea into there was that type of thing
rivalry.
Going on.
Like, the rivalry took over. Really?
No wonder you won nothing. Up. Jesus.
Yeah. This is why Phil did so much work on environment when he came into the England job, I think, with us. I loved going away with England. I absolutely loved it. And I think especially tournaments, you are away, maybe you'll have your 2-3 weeks.
Did Phil bring you together as a group?
Yeah, he did. He really did. Yeah, his work off the pitch was really good. Serena carried it on, and I think when you're in a tournament, you have the 3-week prep, maybe at St George's Park, which there's not a lot going on. It's great facilities, and then you go away, so you could have like 8-9 weeks together, which is a lot. And if you take away the on the pitch time, more of it is obviously spent around each other. And I absolutely loved it, and I think that's why we ended up doing well, because you have to enjoy it. Like, playing for your country is the biggest thing ever. And I'm sitting here now and I find it quite sad that at times you just didn't enjoy it, because you look back and it should be the best days.
I don't think there's any England squads, like you mentioned, like the golden generation that had the competitiveness amongst the team like that generation. None. Not in England.
Right, Frank, when I finish with Chelsea, go back... So Chelsea now, but Chelsea to start with, but going back to when obviously Jose joined, what was that like? What happened at Chelsea when he arrived, and what impact did it have on your career?
As a group, he brought a huge self-confidence that rubbed off. We all saw the press conference and we all felt it the minute he walked into the room. So I think we were a good group, good players. So he came into a team already that had come second, I think, the year before. Had a bit of a core of a British. The dressing room, we sort of not ran the dressing room, but he had that strength within the dressing room. I think in that first year, we got Didier, we got Big Pete, Cavalier came in. So he went bang, his four other players, top players, to make you a better team. Set us up in a pretty simple structure, 4-3-3. But it was, at the time, it was seen as a little bit forward-thinking, but not much to it, looking back. But it was more, for me, the mentality of, we're going to win, and I'm telling you so. And when you've got loads of mid-20s, young-year-old lads sort of taking that in, I think we all took it in. So it was
The first league match against United, or was that the second?
You gave the goal away.
I was sent a half. Yeah. I didn't give the goal away.
You
I didn't give the goal away. Have we got on video? Let's get the video.
That's a good Johnson, wasn't it?
Did you give the centre half? Did you like stuff?
No, but that was you're on about a new manager coming in, putting a statement down, and it was a big win, even that.
It was.
Early in the season.
Well, we played a diamond that day for some reason. We went into the 4-3-3. I don't know why we played a diamond. And it was a bit stodgy, the game. It wasn't a great game when we nicked it 1-0. But then as we got in, as we hit the ground running, all new things, which are fantastic man management, you'd sit there and go, hey, the next six games, we're going to win that. It was new to us. Do you know what I mean? No one had come in with that bravado. Yeah, and we're going, well, we will. Then that kind of, it went through to the team. And on a personal level, it was probably pretty similar. It was like I was, you know, a good player. I was getting better. I'd had a decent year before with Ranieri in the second year. But I needed someone. And his way with me was to kind of go, you're there. And that's, you need to win titles now. And me being impressionable was like, okay, boss, I'll try and do that. And it helped me, do you know what I mean? And it was a lot of that. As I said, it was not loads of information to give me about that. It was almost like, you'll be there, McAlady will be there, the other one might stay a bit more than you, there's your wingers. We do this, we do that. And, you know, it was spot on. So some of the greatest things for me in management are simple things.
Yeah.
Simple things, mentally simple things on the pitch as well.
You mentioned earlier when you were talking about Mashiri, about he doesn't turn up, but then Roman Abramovich didn't turn up, but he was successful. What was sort of like... How was Chelsea so successful and the model became so successful? Even changing managers all the time.
And still wins.
What was it about Chelsea under Abramovich that made it such a sort of success machine, really? It was. I mean, for many years, they were only United won more Premier League titles.
Well, then it's the players, isn't it? I think if you explain it that way, we had such a strong core of players that when the manager changed, a few would be disgruntled a bit about it, a few would be happy because they might get back in the team. But the basis of it remained that we had John being the captain that was there visually for everyone to see. Myself, who was behind that, a bit quieter, but maybe like my training, I was a bit of a standards man. Didier was like looking after the boys in the dressing room, the African boys and Essien and these ones and the French speaking and Big Pete. So we just had this, however smart
big
it was.
Big personalities, huh? Yeah.
Big personalities. Big spine. I don't know how much, you know, if they would have stuck with Jose through that patch and he'd stayed on. I know Jose's history now sort of looks like he moves on after a few years anyway. But Carlo left after 2 years. Like top managers. So I'm not sure it was necessarily the right bit. He did manage to get over the line again with the players. Do you know what I mean? And it became, you know, the Roman sort of idea. He came and had a few harsh meetings with us in those few years when he was more present.
What would he say?
He'd just come in. One was before we played at Old Trafford in the Champions League. He'd just come and he'd just sort of be really harsh. I remember him saying once before the Old Trafford at the hotel game, and I think Chicharito went for and scored early in the game, Champions League quarter final or something. And he sat down and went, and this was translated, which makes it even harsher. You know, the Russian translated. You're waiting for the translation game. It's not going to be good. You know what I mean? And he was like, do I think we're going to win this game? No. Do I think, will you be here at the end of the season if we don't win this game? A lot of you know. You know, and that was being translated to us. Like 2 hours before the game. Typically, we all go out like little kids go, shouldn't have been saying that before the game and all that.
Yeah.
But really, what he did with
I
those...
I didn't realise he was so invasive like that.
He only had a few, I've got to say. He'd come to a lot of games, and in the early years, my bigger memory is him cuddling us a bit. Not too close, but you know, down, high five and off. And that was great. But there were a couple of times, I remember with Carlo 1 year, he came in, we won the league and we won the FA Cup, but we got knocked out by Inter Milan in the Champions
League. Jose was the manager.
And by Jose, the bits at the bridge. Wow. And he came in and absolutely went at everybody from ourselves and manager. It was strong. And then after that, we went about 9 unbeaten. We were winning. So when we started, we won 7-0, 8-0 at the back end of the season. And it was, we had a good team, Anelka, Drogba, Malouda, and we were strong. But we'd been a bit like that. He came in and went, bosh, and everyone walked out of the room. And then we went on a big run. Not saying it was just that, but there was definitely, so when I say it was the players, there was also a cultural thing around the club there. Yeah. It was like, we're winners. Coming second was a disaster.
Yeah.
And I felt it as well. We as a group of players, not the ones that go, see you later next year, lads, we're in the Champions League next year anyway.
So it was his culture and mentality, really. Though.
Yeah, I think so. I think it just landed and then it was what it was. And maybe sacking managers, as much as it could have been good or bad, was a reminder of the brutality of it. So if you don't live up to the standards of the owner, and if you don't live up to the standards of the dressing room, when we were strong on that, there were loads of players that came in, you know, like, not to say this is the reason, but Kevin De Bruyne came through and moved on, and Mo Salah and that, and they're obviously world-class players, to say the least, now. Yeah. But there were a lot of players that got patted away
That just worked for Chelsea, Frank, at the time. Like, I don't know if that would obviously, if you hear about owners getting involved, people go, that's out of order. Yeah. It's this.
What's he doing?
But obviously, your dressing room was strong enough to deal with all that. But
I love that culture of Chelsea, and in terms of, they were just a winning machine.
Would you like an owner coming in, Jim, if you were a player? And,
oh, no. Yeah. But the thing about Chelsea at that time and changing managers, there was always this feeling from the outside that Abramovich wanted Chelsea to be like Barcelona, the way they played a little bit. And I could never understand it because I'm thinking, just win every season. I'm always thinking, why would you change that model? Because your model almost reminded me a little bit the way I'd always see like a Bayern Munich where... Big, powerful, strong. You wouldn't want to play against. You've got quality, but it's not massively overplaying. But your team, when you play against you, you're thinking, why are you going
to
beat them?
Horrible to play against.
Yeah. And I used to just think, Steph, you're winning.
I presume with that one, I'm presuming a bit here, but there might have been a lot of people around the owner, the ownership, that would be going, oh, you've done well here, but you could play like Barcelona. Yeah. That's amazing. And I presume that might have been, because we'd probably tried that.
Scolari came in, didn't it?
Scolari vs Boas. Yeah. We tried to be a bit more expansive, and it didn't work, really. And then when they left halfway through their seasons, we went, Gus didn't come in and went bang. Yeah. And then we went with the players.
But even with Carlo and with Conte, the type of managers that are a bit more formulaic and methodical, aren't they?
But the thing with it as well was I felt that the Chelsea fans didn't demand. They were not looking for tiki-taka football. They loved Drogba up front and me joining on if we did go long and John, like, you know what I mean? Like, there was no real desire for it. But maybe, you know, like the world was changing a bit. Tiki-taka was amazing. Let's try and do that. But it never really worked.
When Abramovich came in, was he talking sense? Did he know the game? Was he like... Or was he just digging people out? Did you have a run of bad results or something? Or
it had been off the back of a run of results. He never declared himself as to why. It was never like, go, because of this. It was more of a, if I don't see you lot winning, then we'll have to make changes. It was that cut and dried. Looking back, I appreciate. And even at the time, I was a little bit like, oh, myself. Mm. You know what I mean? Like, you don't want to be one of those
players. It worked.
Yeah, it did.
Wow.
It
did.
Moving on to modern day Chelsea, you talk about a winning mentality under Roman Abramovich. The new ownership have come in and they've tried to obviously do something completely different from a strategic point of view, sort of the 8-year contracts. Do you feel like we're at the beginning of a winning, you know, you've spent 11, get up, 3-4, 5 months, what, 3 months there last season? Do you feel like this is going to be a successful ownership and that they're at the beginning of it? Or do you think it's a little bit rabbit in headlights and they're going to have to change?
I think it's definitely going to take time. Mm. And I think the strategy might have to develop as it goes, because at the minute, you can't forget the one thing that's important when you've been a winning club for 20 years. You've got to win. You've got to keep the fans happy. You've got to keep the media, you know, engaged in it in a way that's not negativity. So I think they're going to have to change. These players have to develop quickly. And I feel for the manager a bit. I'm not feeling sorry for him, but, you know, I understand that change is going to take time for those players to develop.
What is he experiencing there? What did you experience at the end of last season that you said you thought would be difficult this season?
Well, my feeling was, because it was a bit different for me in a way, because I probably had half the squad. I remember going through the squad on the board in the office, and it was like half the squad, at least, and it's just 30 players. Either want to leave or have been told that they're going to leave. And we had 7 games to go that were going against, like, Arsenal playing for the title, Man United playing for Europe, Man City, Brentford, you know, all these teams. You go, if we've got no, you know, this lack of motivation with a group, players want to go, with a few injuries and stuff, it's not going to get there. So when the positive I saw at the end of the season was that those players have to go now for whatever reason. Some you might have said, could you have kept him, but whatever, moved them on and then bring it. But then you're bringing in another batch of players, which is going to take time. And the reality is as well, we're younger players that don't have, you know, you never win anything with youngsters. Like, the reality is now, you look at what Man City and Liverpool are doing, there's a gap. And it's going to take time to do that. So I'm not saying that you have to completely turn the strategy around and go, OK, now go and buy the finished article, you know, go and buy Harry Kane in the summer, or go and buy it. But I think you do have to look at going, OK, talk about spines again. We've got enough in the spine there that's going to pull us through on day. He's going to be vocal on the pitch, going to drive training every day. Because the manager can't do all those things.
No.
You know, players have to take
it. I just look at it and I think... City and Liverpool for sort of 5 or 6 years have probably been the two best teams in Europe or the world, if you like. And I think Chelsea almost forget that this new ownership, it's been that scattergun that you got top four, I think, and got to a cup final in your first season. Then obviously Tuchel comes in. Chelsea were always third under Thomas Tuchel. And what manager could have competed with a Liverpool or a Man City with how good they were? So Chelsea were doing... I thought they were doing fine. Mm-hmm. 2 cup finals against Liverpool. Liverpool won on penalty shoot on both of them. So they were competing with the two best teams in Europe at the time. And then the owner comes in, and then all of a sudden Chelsea look like they're eighth. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, even for a few years, you know, they weren't winning everything. they were still really competitive. They were the best of the rest, if you like. And it's still a competitive league with Spurs, Arsenal, Manchester United at that time. They were still sort of like the best team behind those two. And all of a sudden now, you look at it and you think, they're miles away from the top two. But even sort of like, you look at Villa now, even like a Newcastle, you know, Manchester United last season, it just feels like so quickly, it's just gone from being almost there to just miles away.
Yeah. No, I see what you're saying. It's a Premier League. It moves forward really quickly. Mm-hmm. And at the time, now, as I say, the strategy has been to recruit young, and it's going to take time. Now you're seeing the difficulties of that. So I don't think anyone can expect. I think if Chelsea, you know, progression this year will be starting to play better and get a better feeling around the place. Now, I don't know what it ends up in. It might be eighth, it might be sixth or whatever. I don't know. And that, it's just the reality of it, Carol. I agree with what you're saying.
Just wanted to ask you about Jose Mourinho and perception of managers before. Obviously, Jose was seen as the greatest manager in the world with Pep Guardiola. What do you think's happened in the last few? Do you think the game's moved on in terms of style expectations, or do you think there's still a place for a Jose Mourinho playing the style of play that he plays? Because the perception's changed, hasn't it, around Jose in the last few years? There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a place for it because, you know, not everyone. You manage with your style, and I don't think anyone would expect him to go miles away from that because that's what's given him success over the years. I think the reality is as well, I saw when he lost his job recently that, back to the win percentage, Jose's was 48.2% at Roma, which is his lowest ever. That's why he's got the sack. Well, of course it was. He's at Roma. He's not at Chelsea with a squad that's going to get 70% win percentage. So everyone's got different challenges. He's got them to two finals, European finals. Wins one of them, doesn't win the next one. And I just think, you know, I'm not going to comment too much. I don't know what's Roma. No. I don't watch the Italian football.
Speak to Jose, Frank.
Yeah, on message and stuff.
Yeah.
But I don't. I think it would be quite lazy to kind of go, he's still, you know, like people talk about him in the old, being quite harsh.
Yeah. And he's still a big story up here.
He is. And I know he's, you know, been sent off whatever times over there. That comes with the Jose thing. But when I look at him, I wouldn't want to think about exactly how he is with the players at Roma. Because I've seen a lot of stuff this week as well. Players going, thanks very much. I know that can happen a lot. Mm. Players go, thanks very much, on to the next one. But at the same time, I would have thought he'd adapted. He's a smart man. Yeah. And he can't change from being Jose. He's won him 30 titles or whatever it is. Yeah. So I think there's absolutely a place for him. I think it'd be interesting to see where he pops up next.
A couple of community questions. How much was natural talent versus work rate to become the elite footballer you were?
That should be a question for you, like, as a viewpoint. Do you know what I mean? It's hard for me to say.
Come on, Frank, answer. I was 99% work rate.
But you know what? Yeah, because that's like it's a backhanded compliment.
Frank, what you can do, score goals from midfield, which is a massive talent.
Yeah.
I mean, seriously.
Yeah.
And many people,
you put a lot of work in, Frank, as well.
Yeah.
A lot of work. Yeah. I saw it myself at West Ham, constant finishing and, you know, I mean, everything you was doing in the hard work situation, but then obviously talent. I remember that Harry Redknapp, when he done the interview, saying he's going to be this and he's going to be that. Because I always found it, Frank, very tough for you, especially when I came to West Ham with your dad and your uncle. It was so hard, in respect, even just watching how you had to react to certain stuff. This is what I remember.
Suggestion of nepotism, basically.
Well, yeah, and I remember you, when you went back with Chelsea, and this guy always sent a message, said, "Nice one, Frank. You just do your stuff." But that must have been really tough, Frank, going through that stage there.
Yeah, it was tough because I was probably 17, 18, a kid still, really. So when grown men are giving you a stick for that. But now with reflection, you look back and kind of go, it's probably the making of me. Because at the time when I was a bit soft, but you kind of, and then you get through it and you come through it and it makes you a bit tougher. So I don't reflect on it. It was certainly tough at the time, but also...
Did it drive you to work harder?
Absolutely. Prove people wrong.
Yeah.
That stuck with me through my career, and the start of it probably started there a little bit. Yeah. But I was in a great environment too at West Ham because I had Harry Redknapp, and as much as it was hard for me having my dad and uncle, it probably did help a tiny bit, do you know what I mean? In certain ways, for a little step, and then all of a sudden I went and did the step. But players like yourself, Di Canio, Neil Ruddock, Harry had a nice little environment to train, and I loved it because I was looking up to people. Yeah. The socials were amazing, weren't they? But I think the original question, I think hard work is a talent in itself. So if you're prepared to put in the hole, it's very natural to me, like to want to.
Did Harry come up one time and really defend you?
It was brilliant. It's a beautiful watch. It aged very well.
We used to room together in England under 21s, didn't we? And when you think
how was that?
Lively. Let's leave it there. But I always, when I think of like sort of, you know, like the superstars of the England team, and you think of like a Rio or a Michael Owen or a Rooney or Stevie. they don't do the 21s. They just go, just bypass it, don't they? Whereas we were there for like 2 or 3 years. We had to do your stint. And you don't normally see someone like that. You then became one of the stars of the team. And I think that's testament to sort of your ability, of course, but also mentality and the work that you put in as well. Because, as I said, it wasn't like you were seen as a star at England under 21s. No. It was like there wasn't like a clamour to get you in the squad.
Yeah.
And myself had sort of 2021. So you sort of done that stint and didn't really become a regular for England, did you?
No, 25, 26? Yeah. Wow. It's probably 50-50. You know, like I think in the big scheme of players, that probably a player to get to that top level. Some naturally it's really evident. Others, I think, you've got to work hard, and that's part of the game. Because when I was 17, even at school, I was probably not always the best player in the team, or West Ham youth team, say. But then I want to be, so I used to run. But again, fate, things go in your favour. I had a footballing family, my dad going, you are going to be. You're going to run.
He was a worker.
Lose
he
the puppy fat hard, and Frank. Run, do you know what I mean? Like, all those things.
He was one of those, absolutely. He trained his bollocks off.
Yeah, and I'm lucky at that because I've seen kids go by the wayside that don't have that push. Maybe their parents are not as invested or whatever it is that didn't. So I had things in my favour, but it stuck with me. And I had like an obsession with training. It
was like scoring goals from midfield wasn't by chance, because I remember watching a video that you did with the Man City younger players that circulated at City, and you were talking about the timing into the box. And I remember just looking at the detail that you were sharing with them, and I was like, wow, this is incredible, especially for me as a midfielder. Probably should have followed you more than him. I got sent off a lot, but like you put detail into absolutely everything, didn't you? Like your standards, and was that goal scoring something that you've worked on a lot?
Yeah, well, I worked on. I was always like a practical man. I learned it from people like Wright, because we would do finishes from all sorts of angles and at all sorts of speeds, proper speed.
Yeah.
So I would always look at where am I going to have my shots from? They're either going to be arriving onto something, which will be one or two touches in the box, or it's going to be me shifting it outside the box and hitting it. And I would just do that again and again and again. And then you layer it up with, like, when the winger's got it, do you wait? Do you run off the back of someone, diagonal runs, all those things? You know, I think a lot of top players, it's an intelligence. I think it's quite simple, personally. Maybe that was one of my talents, being able to clock the right time to run. I'm never going to beat five players, really. I can clock the right time to run and maybe be fitter than
you. It's hard to coach that, Frank. And I think it's a lot of that's instinct, when to make those runs. I know you did a brilliant shot outside the box, but also getting the end of stuff. And again, you're talking about other players, scores he had it. Gerrard. And a lot of people actually do have the good movement, but when they do get in there, they panic and they can't finish. That's very hard to coach that.
Yeah, the timing, definitely. Time, so many times now, balls go across and I'm like, where are they? Like, so I do think it's a real art.
I think you've got to be really hungry as well. I was really hungry for goals.
Yeah, that's a good point. I remember I used to work with players, midfielders. You talk about getting the box, and players would turn around and said to me, you'd mention you and Gerrard and Scholes and all these boys, and they would turn around and go, but I've made 3 runs. You go, you know, sometimes they've made 20 runs, but you only see the end of one, maybe. Yeah. You know, you got to keep getting in there and be brave enough to not get there and be brave enough to miss. But players make 3 or 4 runs, they think, I've done, no. Keep getting in there. Be brave enough to get in.
With you, even like,
I knew you were going to say that.
Honestly. you'd be watching a game, Chelsea, they'd be like 2 or 3 and up, the game's finished and everyone's just walking around. But if he hadn't scored, he'd always get one in the last minute. He'd keep going, I got that jammy bastard scored again. and his other favourite was, if he hadn't scored, getting loads of shots in and saying sorry before anyone's even had a go at him. I know. Yeah. And he gets it again, he goes again.
I didn't realise you were studying me so kindly. Yeah.
Was a bonus as your contract for scoring goals?
I was just well paid, and that was it.
no bonus stuff,
And last question, which player have you coached that reminds you of yourself the most?
I used to get asked this about Mason Mount. It was just an easy question, do you know what I mean? And I didn't really see it, if I'm honest. I think we had different attributes. We played in a similar area of the pitch, obviously.
And he sort of ran forward, but he's not got the finishing.
Talk
to us about him and his move to United. Talk to us about what you see in him as a player, because obviously you believed in him enormously and got great things out of him. He's obviously struggled in his first bit at United. Just talk to us about him, can you, a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, a bit of injuries as well, to be fair to him, and a team that's struggling and a big negativity in certain ways. But from my point of view, because I took him to Derby, he changed everything for me there, really. Him and Tomori and Wilson, Mason particularly, his level in training was high level. Pressing, brilliant. Off the ball stuff, brilliant. If you want to give him information, takes it like that. Yeah. We'll jump, we'll recover, a great lad, good technically, very good technically. So I think he was really, I think he's really high level in loads of those areas, and a proper lad that you can, as I say, you can give him anything. So I think probably he's probably suffered from a change into a bad
his mentality. I look at him, he looks quite a sort of a I'm trying to say this in the right way, which doesn't sort of, if you like, impact negatively upon him, but he looks like a nice mentality. Has he got that real fierce mentality?
No, he has. He's very driven. Like if you drop him, the face goes.
Right. Okay.
I mean, straight away, he's one of those. And not in a bad way. He's like, no, I want to show you. He absolutely will want to show. He's very determined like that. I wouldn't be sort of like kidded by it, as you say. I see what you mean about the look of him, but he definitely is a determined lad. I'm not just saying it because he's my lad a bit and I've had, you know, a relationship on the pitch in terms of managing him, but I do think he'll come good because of that and because of his talent. Yeah. And once the team gets more structured, because I do think it's important for a structure of your team to say that you're an aggressive eight or you're in a 10. And the only worry I had when he went to Man United was, where does Bruno Fernandes and him fit? And then you go, and then you've got Casemiro. I know it's starting to develop already and change probably away from that as an idea, but you kind of go, where do you fit? And I think when you are, and this is not to dig Mason or to dig Man United actually for bringing him in, but you've got, I think, a player of that level for that level of money, you've got to go, this is the plan.
Yes.
That's what I'd want to hear. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And my question would be, where do we fit?
He's almost got to play centre midfielder. Fernandes playing, he's not a centre midfielder. He's more of a 4-3-3 man, isn't he?
Yeah.
Is he basically the position that you played in that sort of eight, you know, basically one sitter and then one of the two in front?
I would say he's probably slightly more advanced than me in general play. Yeah. I like to arrive from deeper and probably drop down and play a bit more than arrive from deeper. I think he's higher. Where in Tuchel's team that won the Champions League, he's a 10. Highest sort of 10 on the side, two 10s and a 9.
Yeah.
And I think he could do that probably better than I could in a way. I like to come from deeper, so a bit higher up. Could play as a single 10 as well. But again, you're going into the captain of the football club, Bruno Fernandes, is playing there, who hardly gets injured as far as I see it.
Yeah.
So I think that would be a difficult one that is a conundrum to solve as a team to get him, you know, into the team in his best position.
But that's one of his challenges, isn't it? If you're good enough, you've got to find a way, and we can make excuses. And again, the injuries have held him back, no doubt, and he's gone into a difficult, I think, time at United. But if he's got that belief and that personality, you've got to find your way into that team.
Yeah, but Roy, like Frank said, it's the structure. If he's got the right structure, and you can fit him in that. And that's what we were saying about United earlier.
You got to get the team first.
Yeah, get the structure right. Then you could put someone like him in.
You're getting the team first.
I agree on both points, because Mace does have to do it. I think he will. But I think when you go from... Certainly when I had him at Derby, when I managed him at Chelsea, and then Tuchel came in, but they would dominate a lot of games. My team, I'd have him jumping. We'd be quite high up the pitch a lot. Yeah. I do think Man United do a lot of their best work when they're counter-attacking.
Yeah.
They turn him teams around, and Rashford's gone bang, bang, bang. Maybe Mace has got to get to grips with what that looks like for him. Because all that high-pressing stuff's great if you're in a high-pressing team. They're not. Massively high pressing team.
Yeah.
All these sort of stuff in tight areas up the pitch, which I think he's good at and can get better at it, I think, and be more effective in the box, score more goals. I don't think they stay there lows and you're kind of going like that. They actually go their best stuff when I've coached against United is probably have a lot of a ball, but be worried, be careful of that.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure that Mace is one that's going to be going, oh yeah, I'll join you, Marcus. You know what I mean? That's not easy for anybody. No. So, you know, it's different style of play as well.
What's the best piece of advice you've ever had? To finish?
Well, it'd probably be from my mum, and it would be stay humble and keep your feet on the ground no matter what. Do you know what I mean? She was always like, and she used to say rise above it would be her things. So stay humble and rise above shit. And I haven't always managed to do that. I don't think any of us do. Do you know what I mean? But sometimes I check myself a little bit. That'd be that.
Nice.
Brilliant, Frank.
Can I ask you one thing? No, I'm just want to say this. Yeah. Colombo.
Oh no, he's gonna get you. Colombo.
You must be aware, obviously, when you're managing, you do your interviews, and you do that thing where you laugh and then go serious.
Yeah, I'll say that. I don't want
to say it. I love it. I used to love it.
You never heard of that?
No.
Oh, God, you're going to go looking for it now.
No.
I
do you know what you do, or do you try? Or
nah,
are you thinking about doing it?
I've tried to stop it now.
Trying to stop it?
No, but I have. My daughter sent it to me ages ago. Like, it was a meme or whatever they call it. Yeah. I don't even really. But now I've seen it. I can't unsee it. Mm-hmm. But I've done a few press conferences where I've gone, you know, you do it and you go, oh, shit. You know what I mean? Can't help it.
Frank, brilliant.
Cheers.
Thanks, man. Cheers, everyone. Brilliant.
Cheers.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well done.
Thank you.
Thanks
very
much.
Gary, thanks.
Thank you.
I love you.
Enjoyed
James.
Right.
Well done. Frank, go in the middle.
Yeah. Right, James, you go there.
Actually, go.
anti-Irish, isn't it? I tell you.
No.
Thanks. Brilliant.
Thank you.
I
want
to be next to Frank. No, I want to be next to Frank.
Right. Trio chat about how England won that. And,
oh, fuck it up. Oh, yeah, no.
Yeah. I know, I'm trying to be. Yeah.
Oh, if we just stayed at a different hotel, we would have won.
The bus driver. Different bus driver.
Thanks, everyone.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win, and support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Welcome back to Two Judgy Girls. I'm Mary from the Bay.
And I'm Courtney from L.A. TJG is the podcast where we spill all the tea on your favorite reality TV shows, celebrity gossip, and everything in between. We're here to bring you our unfiltered opinions, hilarious commentary, and plenty of laughs along the way.
We're two SDSU Delta Gamma sisters with a microphone and a whole lot of opinions. Each week, we dive headfirst into the wild world of reality television, from Bravo to all the trash TV you could want. We break down the drama, dissect the latest scandals, and share our thoughts on everything from the jaw-dropping moments to the embarrassing antics.
But that's not all. We're not here to just gossip. We're here to connect with you, the jurors, and share our love of all things pop culture. Whether we're dishing on the latest celebrity breakups, discussing our favorite guilty pleasure movies, or sharing embarrassing stories from our own lives, we promise to keep it real, keep it fun, and keep you coming back for more.
Come judge with us.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.